This week's After Dinner Scientist is Eric Brenstrom, former severe weather forecaster with the Met Service, still following meteorology very, very closely. And alas, there is a lot to follow. Eric is on the line once more. Kia ora, Eric. Welcome back to Nights.
Kia ora, Brian. Thank you.
Well, you know, the IPCC came out with its latest report, which, okay, I'm being really, really almost glib here, but it doesn't really say anything different to the last two decades of reports. The only thing is that's different is that now we have more and more evidence of actual warming, and the warnings from the IPCC get shriller. And well, that's about it, really.
I agree. I mean, the warnings I've been reading from the IPCC for more than 30 years have, to me, seemed really grim, because you read what they're saying, and scientifically it's saying we have a real problem. You know, Houston, we have a problem. And it seems not to register with some of the people in the and the political world, to my great disappointment. So, yeah, as you say, it's just the continuation of saying is louder and louder, we have a serious problem.
Okay, let's look at the latest records. Record high temperatures in eastern Antarctica. When you say eastern Antarctica, what bit do you actually mean?
Well, it's, there's a temptation with people to think of it as being a big circle with the South Pole in the centre, but it's not. So if you take the line of longitude 180 degrees, which runs just down east of New Zealand, it goes through the middle of Antarctica and the South Pole's on that. But the bulk of Antarctica is, well, if you look at a map like we would in a normal thing, you would say to the left of the line of 180, which is, in other words, say south of Australia. And in fact, that's also where the highest ground is. So South Pole is by no means the highest part of Antarctica. The Russians have got a station at a place called Vostok, which is more than 4 kilometres high. And that's the place where they had the record temperature on 18th of March. They got minus 17.7, which, you know, it doesn't sound high, it's still very cold, but it broke the previous record for the highest temperature in March by 15 degrees, which is actually the largest margin by which a high temperature has been broken in all of the stations around the world that people follow, where the records are at least 40 years old, to give you some kind of feeling.
I'm pretty sure that Vostok is where the record low temperature was recorded, the minus 70 Celsius?
It was the place, but it was minus, I think, 84 point something or other some decades ago. So, yes, it does have the record for coldest temperature. So this one they got on March the 18th was 35 degrees above average, because they had just about completed the cooling down that they get as they go into autumn. If you look at the graph of average temperature for places like the South Pole and Vostok, they have their highest point in December, January, and then they really fall off the chart till about the end of March, and then they almost flatline through the rest of winter, and then they come screaming up in September when the sun comes back. So for much of the winter, they only cool by another 3 or 4 degrees, but usually they'd be around about minus 60, 65 at this time of year, and not minus 17.7.
So Eric, just to clarify, is this the record warmest temperature for March?
For Vostok.
Right, for March. Yeah, not all-time record, just March.
No, the all-time record high temperature for Vostok is slightly warmer. I think it's minus 14 degrees, 3.7 warmer, which occurred in a December some years ago. So there's a huge difference between December and March in a place like that, because it's, you know, they've lost the sun now, it's all gone dark.
But to get such a mild temperature so late in the summer season, just ahead of the equinox, what caused that, Eric? I mean, what's the short-term reason that this happened?
A long fetch flow of air coming from near Tasmania down over them and then rising up over the plateau, which produced heavy rain on the coast and heavy snow partway up in the journey to Vostok. Once you get into places like Vostok, the annual yearly precipitation is the equivalent of less than 50 millimetres of rain. So it's actually a desert in there. I mean, that's much less precipitation than anywhere in New Zealand. I think our lowest is 350 or something. So most of the action happens to the air mass on the way up over the ice. And so it produced heavy snow. And what interested me was that although some of these sorts of events have happened before and been documented in scientific papers, this is by far the strongest example of it. And it was caused in part because there was what we call a blocking anticyclone southeast of Tasmania. So on the western side of the anticyclone, you had a long northerly fetch going on for many days.
A long northerly fetch, did you say?
Fetch of air, yeah, air flying from Tasmania.
What's a fetch of air,
Eric? Well, it's the length, the distance it's come, it's the length. It's a way of talking about, I suppose, straight-line conditions. We often use it in terms of swells. You know, the longer the fetch of wind blowing over the ocean, the bigger the swell you get. But while this was happening for them, and they were getting relatively warm conditions, on the eastern side of this blocking anticyclone, southeast of Tasmania, Wellington was getting southerly. So that's where we got several periods in February where it wasn't freezing, but it was colder than it ought to be for February, and also grey skies with bits of drizzle. So it was both effects, Antarctica's warmth and our coolness, were caused by this blocking high.
Was it also the same kind of southerly weather that hit Hawke's Bay and Tairawhiti in East Cape?
Well, they got heavy rain out of it, so that's where you were actually bringing air down from the north. So warm air from the tropics was coming down and producing the damaging rain that we saw there, which, you know, was a repeat of something they had not long ago. But what interested me was that at the same time you had massive rain falling over the east of Australia and parts of Queensland and New South Wales, causing flooding that was really damaging, and it was a repeat of something it had 6 weeks before, I think, in that town called Lismore.
Mm.
And I think Sydney might have got its second wettest March, but just inland slightly at the Air Force Base, Richmond Air Force Base, they had the wettest. I think it was actually the wettest March, or it might have even been the wettest month ever on record. So one of the things going on, we've talked about how when you get warm air with much higher water vapour content, you're able to produce more rain. But in the production of that rain, heat is released when the water gas changes to liquid to form cloud and rain droplets. And that heat makes the upward motion in the storm stronger and therefore makes the rainfall stronger. So there's that thing that if you have 1 degree of warming, you get 7% more water vapour if you've got 100% humidity. But that ends up being 15% more rain once you have the feedback effect of releasing heat. But beyond that, there's other feedback effects where with so much heat being released, you get this very strong upward motion causing the rain. And high up, that air spreads out and then begins to sink. And that causes this anticyclone that we had southeast of Tasmania. Well, that's what I suspect. I haven't run that past one of my expert colleagues yet, but you can have this phenomenon whereby a really dramatic weather event can then change the shape of the isobars that you would have had otherwise.
Eric, didn't we have a blocking high to our east here in New Zealand a week back?
Yes, as well, which is to some degree a seasonal thing. It's because of the fact that when you go beyond the tropics, you get subtropical highs. So that was more of a normal thing rather than special because of the rain in Australia.
Record warmth at the other end of the planet. I'm talking about not Antarctica, but the Arctic now. And again, what's record warmth at this time of year?
Well, the record temperatures occurred in the island of Svalbard, which is belongs to Norway, but it's north of Norway in the Arctic Circle.
It's one of those places I've always wanted to go to because it's basically the northerly point where you kind of have ordinary kind of cities and towns, I think.
Yes, well, it used to be a mining place. I think, I don't know how much cities, but they've got villages. And
But
the thing is, if you wander around there, you have to have a big gun on account of the fact that you may bump into a polar bear, which is wandering around.
I've read about that.
It's polar bear territory. The interesting thing was it was on the same date as the Antarctic warmth. And the thing that was going on was that they had a low, deep, and very rapidly east of the United States over the Gulf Stream, a thing they call explosive cyclogenesis. And when that low clipped the southern end of Greenland, Greenland had its lowest atmospheric pressure on record, which was 934 hectopascals. And so what that meant was you had a very big, intense low, and therefore east of the low centre, you had a big fetch of air coming out of the mid-latitudes and punching up into the Arctic. So although, in a sense, there was no direct link between the two, the indirect link is that, once again, with hotter-than-average ocean in the Gulf Stream and hotter-than-average ocean near Tasmania, You're putting a lot more water gas in the air. When something like a low starts to deepen, you can put a lot more energy into it and deepen it a lot faster. And the end result is the air coming out of the mid-latitudes is a stronger and longer current, and that going over Svalbard gave them their record temperatures.
Is a low pressure of 934 hectopascals something one can feel, like would your ears kind of pop or something?
Oh, that's a good question. If it happens gradually, maybe not, you know, over a period of many hours. What interested me when people were doing some experience with tornadoes, they managed to get a pressure device onto the road sort of 60, 50 seconds before a tornado went through and they escaped, an EF3, so a fairly strong one. And they found something like 100 hectopascal drop in pressure over the space of, I think, a minute, but maybe most of that drop was actually in 20 seconds. So I think had you been inside that tornado and survived, as people occasionally do, then you will probably have had your ears pop. But just ordinarily, not so much. Although I did see something somewhere, I haven't quite checked it out, but there's an argument somewhere that pregnant women are much more likely to go into labour when there's a very low pressure nearby. So there could be something there. And also once I read that eels that migrate from the freshwater rivers into the sea, they tend to congregate at the river mouth and then go out when the pressure's low, because that's when they're expecting a lot of rain, and that gives them some fresh water in the ocean to make it easier to do the transition from fresh to salt.
If women are more likely to go into labour when the pressure is low, that would mean, wouldn't it, that there's going to be a disproportionate number of babies born during storms, wouldn't it?
Well, it might, and I'm not exactly in my home turf with this one, and I think it might be necessary to talk to a medical expert before I make too many faux pas.
Any medical specialists, obstetricians listening, text us 2101. Anything to that? Let's put the jigsaw pieces together here.
Yes, very good.
Storms in England. I hadn't paid much attention to the English weather. Has it been unusually bad or just ordinary?
Yes, they had a lot of these ones that they now give names to in succession. I think Dudley, Eunice, Franklin, only weeks apart, days apart sometimes. I saw a guy who was from south of Scotland where he was saying on an interview that their forestry suffered, and he estimated they'd lost 8 million trees just in that, not in the sort of neighbourhood, but in the larger area of southern Scotland. And then trees kept coming down on the others. So in total, England might have lost over 10 million trees in these storms. But the story that caught my attention on the coast of Norfolk, with erosion as the seas banging into the very fragile cliffs there, things fall down. And then if you walk along in the next low tide, you might find them. And a woman last week found a treasure chest poking out of the sand, partially covered up. When she pulled it out, it seemed to be Victorian. It had VR on the lock, and when they broke it open, it had things inside, including a watch, but coins, gems, all sorts of things. So it's interesting what the sea will find for you on that coast.
It sounds very Dickensian. Sounds almost like Great
one,
Expectations.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, it does. But my favourite one was, I think it was about 8 years ago on the same coast nearby, a storm uncovered in a layer of mudstone a set of footprints. And when they dated them, it came in around about 900,000 years old. So they were, they think, an ancestor of us known as Homo antecessor, even more ancient than Homo heidelbergensis, which is more ancient than Neanderthal. So those footprints they recorded in all the different ways they do nowadays, but eventually the mudstone got washed away. So it's a place where coins turn up, bones turn up, rhinoceros bones, all sorts of things. So on the one hand, sad and tragic, but on the other hand, fascinating, picking up the bits and pieces.
Any other records you care to discuss, Eric?
The United States has been having a drought going on for much of the last 22 years. So it's the worst drought they've had in the last 1,200 years, where they look at paleoclimate indicators like tree rings to try and get a handle on it. So over the last 22 years, I think 18 have been drier than average. They've had a few years with a bit of rain. But that's how we get these photos of the Lake Mead behind the Hoover Dam, where there's a huge, I don't know, 30-metre sort of strip of the bank of the lake is a white colour and bald because the lake's so low. So some of the climatologists there are talking about it's not the drought is now the wrong word to describe it, because the word drought makes you think it's going to finish, whereas what they are saying is this could be the new normal, and it's going to threatens the irrigation waters for hundreds of golf courses across America.
That'd be the least of their worries, but maybe it isn't, and that in itself is perhaps a worry. Eric, I was talking to Chris Brandolino from NIWA about this when I was doing the Lately Shift for Karen a few weeks back, and I asked him, okay, I can understand we get more rain when it's warmer, there's more evaporation, and I can understand that there's more energy in the rain, in the air, because it's warmer, so it can hold more moisture and therefore dump more moisture. But what I don't quite understand still is why in a warming climate you would get more extreme drought as well.
Well, an awful lot of the action's going on in the tropics, so that's where you're getting huge amounts of extra rain and huge amounts of extra heat released. And as we were talking before, when that happens over one area, the great amount of air that rises up then spreads out at high altitude, and it cools by radiating heat away to space, and then it sinks to form anticyclones. So all around the world, the belt of anticyclones outside the tropic, known as the subtropical anticyclones, have becoming more intense and more long-lived, and this has brought drought to the Mediterranean area, including places like Syria, where it led to, it contributed to the war there. And it's also been happening in the southern hemisphere. So there are places there where it's always been very dry and you hardly notice that it's even more dry than it used to be. But some of those anticyclones are becoming broader and they're moving a bit further into the mid-latitudes. So that's creating trouble in places where there didn't used to be so much trouble. And it's now and again when the anticyclone might briefly break down, a storm coming out of the tropics, tropical cyclone, for example, can bring rain to one of those places where you have been having droughts in between the heavy rain. So it's that funny paradox that you get both heavier rain but also more frequent droughts, and it can even happen at the same geographical location.
Is it possible, Eric, that if we are able to do what the IPCC suggests we do, and that is stop increasing the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, if we were able to do that, would the current situation with our atmosphere maybe stabilise? Are we going through more extreme events because, to be very crude about it, the atmosphere is adjusting to this extra energy? Might it stabilise?
Oh, if we cut back on the emission of carbon dioxide, yes. So that's our belief and our hope, is if we can stop the emission of carbon dioxide at the rates that has been happening. And, of course, it's actually been increasing, despite 30-odd years of people saying don't do it. More coal and more oil and more gas has been burnt. So far, the rate at which carbon dioxide is entering the atmosphere has been increasing, as well as the fact that the absolute level has kept on going up.
But you're saying we need to get CO2 out of the atmosphere, not
yes.
just stop, because what I'm really getting at is that if we don't reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere and therefore the greenhouse warming effect it has, we are stuck now with what we've got. We're not going to go, this is not going to stabilize. The only way to stabilize it is to get energy out of the atmosphere, and the only way to do that is to get the greenhouse gas out of the atmosphere.
And trees are very good at that. So we want more trees, the right sort of trees in the right places. And we certainly want people to stop burning coal and gas and get into alternative supplies of electricity, solar and wind, for example. And there are attempts being made to find ways to suck air through machines and extract the carbon dioxide, but they haven't been especially successful so far. I think they end up using more energy than the carbon dioxide they take out. So we have to explore things like that. And you know, it's becoming a major concern because all around the world, coastlines are having, you know, things fall into the sea. The rainfall records are being broken in many, many places, and the heat is being broken in many, many places. So it's a matter of urgency that we stop emitting the vast quantities of carbon dioxide we are from burning coal, oil and gas. And if we can find a magic way to extract carbon dioxide from the air, and growing trees is one of those ways.
We're already at 1 degree above pre-industrial levels, aren't we?
1.1.
Yes, yeah. We're on the way to 1.5, which is supposedly the safe upper limit. Eric, how do you feel about all this? We've been talking about this now for, I think, a decade and a half. There's no real sign yet of, in this country, of what I would say is government action that is actually pushing back. At very best, you could say what governments have done in this country and most Western countries, at least English-speaking ones, is maybe slow down the rate of CO2 being released, but that's about the best we've any of us are better to do. How do you feel about that, Eric?
Well, yeah, not great. I mean, the atmosphere doesn't give out any prizes for good intentions. So, you know, what we have seen in the last few decades is vast amounts of money spent on advertising by all companies and governments trying to boast about how good they're doing. And we need to take realistic action, and it needs to happen as soon as possible. So, at one level, I have a certain optimism, having read a lot about the Second World War, and you see how that horrendous disaster was eventually turned around by a lot of people doing a lot of things as fast as they could. You know, human ability to pull its dramas, its tragedies out of the fire at the last minute is quite impressive, and I retain a small level of hope that we will start to do the right thing fast enough to rescue ourselves. Otherwise, well, if you melt all the ice down in the Antarctica, a great many of us are going to go underwater.
Well, that's the least of our worries. We can outpace sea level rise. It's if we don't have enough food, Eric.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, that does come into it. And, of course, warmer temperatures often means crops are less productive, and lack of rain means you don't have the crops anyway. So there is a terrific threat to world food supply in this. And, of course, we're seeing that now with the war in Ukraine. That's an additional thing. And so people are suddenly noticing that not only are we having trouble getting wheat out of Russia and Ukraine, but we're actually having trouble getting wheat out of other places where there are droughts that weren't meant to be there. And so the impact will flow through in the next decade to everyone's experience of going to the supermarket.
Eric, thank you very much for joining us again.
My pleasure.